And that's ultimately, I would say, the biggest thing that I think we miss out on so often in individual player development workouts is that the skill happens completely out of context of the game. And what we know about it from motor learning skill acquisition is that that doesn't lead to the best transfer to the game.
Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches podcast. This is Adam Gordon, and today we are joined by Chris Oliver of BasketballImmersion.com. Chris spent 17 years as a head coach in Canada at Queen's University and the University of Windsor, and he had a ton of success there. 6 regular season championships, 10 years in the top 10, 3 Coach of the Year awards. Sounds impressive, right? Well, it is. But what's even more impressive is his unique take on coaching the game of basketball. He does it through something called basketball decision training. He doesn't believe on teaching 5-on-0 or 4-on-0. Everything that he does has some sort of element of decision making and training his players to make decisions on the fly. Even when he puts in sets or does shooting drills, there's always some sort of aspect of decision making, and it's never just his team out there repeating a skill over and over again. Really unique take, and he's sharing this take on his website, basketballimmersion.com. If you're interested in learning more, visit the site, become a member, only $247 a year. It's really high level content. I know you'll enjoy it. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Please subscribe to the podcast, write us a review, and follow along with what we're doing at risingcoaches.com. Chris Oliver, basketballimmersion.com. Chris, do you ever have deja vu?
I feel like it sometimes. I mean, it's so wonderful to have conversations with you and everyone else I have conversations with, and always happy to discuss any concepts in basketball.
Yeah, well, I have to thank you because we did this podcast about 2 weeks ago, and something happened with the mechanical side on my end. We had a corrupted file. I had to fire my producer. I don't have a producer. I'm just kidding. But yeah, it was probably one of the most important conversations in basketball history that no one will ever hear. So I appreciate you taking the time to do it again.
Well, at least we had the moment together. Let's make another.
Absolutely. Let's do it. Well, let's jump right in. Tell us about BDT. What is it? And tell us more.
Well, again, BDT is basketball decision training, and it's become, you know, it's become this thing that I think is a little bit bigger than what people think it is. And BDT shooting probably originally was the concept, which is that I somehow bridge a gap between on air, which means no defense, and live offense versus defense. And BDT shooting essentially is this. There's some type of cue that the passer gives to the shooter to make the practice more random and variable, and also connecting the idea that there is a decision that goes along with the skill application. So those things combine to be able to heighten the mental effort that a player puts into their training, their individual skill training, their player development. And why I say it's a bigger idea than that, because obviously there's decisions in every point of basketball, offense and defense, there's decisions all the time. But the basic concept started with this idea of how to cue a decision within individual skill development workouts so that we can connect the skill to the game. And that's ultimately, I would say, the biggest thing that I think we miss out on so often in individual player development workouts is that the skill happens completely out of context of the game. And what we know about it from motor learning skill acquisition is that that doesn't lead to the best transfer to the game. That essentially a player has to relearn a lot of things when they do it live offense versus defense.
For example, your best practice for you and for your teams over the years was not so much repetition of a skill, for instance, shooting in a spot. You'd rather throw in some sort of factor that made them have to make a decision on the fly and not know exactly what was going to happen and react, And to you, that's a better way of understanding and learning a skill rather than just repetition, correct?
So initially in learning, and I don't want people to think I'm anti-block practice. Block practice is doing repetitive repetitions of the exact same skill, the exact same way with no variation. So there's a value to that. There's a value to that for comfort and confidence for the player. And there's a value for that for initial learning. And then I think the third part of that, which is where more I would use it, is there's a value for that for emphasis. So coming back to emphasis, say you have a player that's struggling with their confidence shooting. I'll go block their reps and say, hey, let's shoot 10 in a row from the spot. They'll make 8 out of 10. And then I'll tell them, what are you talking about? You're crazy. You can shoot the ball. It's not technique. It's your mental approach, your mental attitude to this. So that would be an example of block practice. So yeah, shooting a repetitive shot over and over again. So what we know, and this is research, this isn't me, this is people way smarter than me, sport researchers and learning psychologists and all these people that have spent time in the learning domain, is that when we mix things together, it causes a player to be, it forces a player, an athlete in this example, to have to retrieve the information, meaning there's thinking. And this thinking and this retrieval process leads to more permanence, which learning means a permanent change of behavior. And it leads to this player, because they've had to retrieve it and heighten their mental effort, being able to retain it. And then, of course, if we use it more within the context that is actually used within a game, then it becomes more likely that the skill is transferred. And that's the problem with block practice, really, to be honest, is that when in a game do you shoot 10 shots in a row from the same spot without thinking? And what we know about that scenario is maybe on the first 3 reps, you have to think a little bit about distance, about arc, about power. But after that, it becomes mindless because you've already done it. And it's just you memorizing and repeating. Now, I don't know about your school, but when I memorized something in school, I didn't remember it 2 weeks later. And that's really what we're trying to avoid, is that idea of memorizing plays and scripts and sequences. Rather, we're trying to learn them and retain them.
Well, what I love about this is that there is, you know, research and data behind all of it. It's not just your gut feeling. You actually have evidence-based teaching that you're using. And that when you talked about memorization, it makes me think, I grew up a big Lakers fan. I'm from Southern California, and Shaq obviously was a notoriously bad free throw shooter. And they used to talk about how he'd sit there and practice and shoot 500 in a row and make 460 of them. And then he'd get in the game and make just under 50%. Which leads me to another question. Like, what do you do about free throw shooting? Like, how do you incorporate BDT into free throws?
What you should be concerned about if you put in that many repetitions and it's not transferring is that you're doing something wrong in practice. And I don't think there's enough coaches that, again, consider how different their practice is from the game. And that's why, I mean, and we'll get to this, but most of my practices, if you would watch them, would be offense versus defense, using constraints-led approach, which I'll explain a little bit later, but basically, I'm using something to shape a player's behavior so that we still get all of our coaching interventions in. We still do all the things to be able to develop our players. We stop them within the context of the game. We ask questions. We stimulate their thinking. All the same things that coaches do, but we just do it directly within the game. That's what I would refer to as a games approach. So we can get into all that. But that would be the concern with Shaq practicing free throws that much in it, not transferring to the game. So free throws are tricky, right? Because it's more of a mental thing than it is a physical thing. The action of shooting a free throw is not inherently that difficult, and it's certainly not difficult for that level of player. But the mindset, the mental pressure that's on in those moments, it's actually one of those few times in a game where our focus is broadened. Like, we're able to keep our focus really narrow within a game because we're immersed in the moment. You can talk about flow. You can talk about all these other things. But actually, when a free throw happens, it's one of those times that you become way more aware that you are the focal point and everyone is watching you. And that becomes more of a mental challenge than a physical challenge. And I think we're obsessed with the physical part of the free throw, but it's really the mental part of the free throw that would distinguish success, I think, for so many players. Now, certainly there's a transfer between, you know, the ability to shoot the ball and the ability to shoot free throw, but there's a real disconnect if he's making 90% in practice and 50% in the game, and that relates more to the physical. So I've talked with coaches before, just as a simple thing is, one, I've gone through a season or two without ever practicing free throws in practice, literally never practicing them. And it had no impact on our shooting percentage. We were number 11 in country one year.
Really?
Never did any, you know, free. No, we shot a lot and we shot a lot of threes, but we never shot a free throw. But we did spend time on their mental routine, and we spent a time with them going through some type of mental rehearsal with the words they say to themselves, the breathing, you know, how many dribbles, blah, 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 you know, all those type of mental routines. We did that. But we didn't do anything to do with actual physical practice. And then the other thing I say to coaches is randomized free throws. If you want a representative number from practice, is let's say, hey, okay, at random points, I mean completely random, not on your practice plan. Someone maybe reminds you if you have other coaches, is, hey, two free throws. Okay, everyone goes shoots two free throws. It started, boom, go, right back to practice. Two free throws. Okay, out of a drill, right to two free throws, right back to the drill. Completely randomize them, because the other part of how we shoot free throws in practice is they're very predictable, right? When free throws happen in games, they happen in completely different random moments, right? You don't know if you're going to shoot a free throw, because I mean, you do know you're going to shoot a free throw when it's called, but you don't know when that free throw is going to come to you. And I like to create those moments in practice as well to randomize them. And that number was more, when we did that through a season, that number was closer to the free throw percentage of our players in a game. Just because we randomize them within practice.
That's interesting. What other things did you see show up in games from your team after going through BDT-specific drills in practice? Well, let me back up. Maybe you can tell us what a practice looks like for you and then tell me what showed up in games.
So a practice in my world is essentially 4-on-4, 5-on-5. And what we would do is, you know, some coaches' perception of 5-on-5, 4-on-4, let's say 5-on-5, let's just stick with 5-on-5. Some coaches' perception of that is that you let the players play and then you give them some summary feedback. Whereas in my version of what a games approach is, or how we'd practice within 5-on-5 is that at any moment when I deem it necessary, we will stop it within 5-on-5. So we will coach them within the game. So my command would be hold or foul. Hold means stop. We're going to somehow engage them. Foul usually means there's a mistake and we're going to recreate. Usually we would go back and say, okay, say someone made a mistake off a free throw, or someone made a decision off of a free throw where I wanted to get them to think differently about other possibilities. I would say hold. I would say recreate. We'd go back to that exact situation, because I would stop it literally just after the pass anyways. In that moment, we go right back to that situation through questions or through some type of engagement. I would get them to think, say, hey, what was the possibility? What was your thought process? Or sometimes because of the speed of the moment, I might just say, hey, listen, you should have saw this opportunity because this is what the defense did. Because that's in the context, because it's offense versus defense and the moment just happened, That feedback is more immediate. It's more impactful. It's not generalized, so it's very specific. And then that, from there, we just go right back into playing from that exact moment, and we continue the repetition. And we might play multiple trips. We might play three trips, or you know, it's not per se just up and down all the time. The other part of that is this constraint-led approach, which we might initially create some type of scenario where I want to shape behavior, knowing that something's going to happen first. Let's say, again, we're working on wing ball screens and the defense has two possibilities. They can shock it, hedge it, whatever you want to call it, or they can drop coverage it. And then the offense has to make decisions off of that. So we're working on decision-making versus aggressive or non-aggressive defense. The offense doesn't know when it's coming, but one of those two scenarios is going to get shaped So I know I'm working on that. I'm working on the ball, off the ball, and different things with that. So hopefully that's easy to understand and digest in a sense. But what value is that? Well, the value is that it's got context immediately to the game, is that we don't have to reteach something within the game because they're playing the game. All practice. We've removed all fluff. No drills that don't happen in the game. They're playing the game. And then the other value is that I find that our players became more adaptable to situations that weren't scripted. So we still run plays. Like we run scripted plays or something like that. You know, we'll run up screen, down screen, do a stagger. Scripted play. Boom. There you go. But within that play, they can play within unstructured moments a little bit more because that's how we practice. We always practice within that environment where they can be flexible, they can be adaptable, and they can play out of possibilities rather than certainties. And basically think about this. Anytime your player knows the answer within a drill or within a 5-on-5, 4-on-4 situation, they know the answer, they must execute 100% certainty, that's probably not game-like. Because that's not how the game's played. With some exceptions, our players have to figure things out more often than they have to follow a script. And I think the best players play with that creativity and that possibility rather than certainty.
Yeah, and you talk about this a lot, is probably a result of this if you're going to practice this way. Practices might look messy at times, and a lot of coaches have an issue with that. A lot of coaches like to have control and like to have it look good, but you got to be okay with practice being a little messy and mistakes happening, correct?
So the evaluation can't be in practice. And that's hard. That honestly, that's the hardest part. But all this process is that because your practices look messy, because there's mistakes and mistakes are necessary for learning and your players have to fight for their learning and all these different things that come from that, your practices won't be perfect. And perfect is not learning. Keep that in mind. If your players just did a drill, say they did three-man weave up and down the floor and no drops, all make layups, met the time and met the goal, and it was perfect. Well, that's not learning. That means they can already do it, and that's more comfort and confidence. And again, I'm not saying don't do that. I'm just saying that we remove that fluff. What's the point of that? The point of that, great. Makes me feel good, makes my players feel good. There's value to that. But ultimately, very little from that transfers to the game, because the game's played in a whole different context than that. There's no decisions. It's not game-like. And that's really what we try and do. And, I try and if you came to my practice and said, hey, well, you complimented me, said that was a perfectly organized practice. Players were perfect. I would be offended by that. It means I didn't do my job, because my job is to make my players struggle and have them fight for their learning as much as possible within practice. And then the game is the evaluation of practice. Leaving practice, I can't evaluate practice and say, oh, wow, we're so much better. Nope. The only thing that helps me know if we're better is how we perform in a game, because that's ultimately the test of transfer, is are they retaining and transferring the skills or the decisions or the systems I'm doing in practice, are they happening in a game? And that's great, because that comes back to the evaluation of, well, what are you spending practice time on? Like, I challenge coaches, look at your practices after the fact, and then compare it to the game and say, what are we doing in practice that's actually happening in a game and what is not, right? Because we waste so much time in practice with stuff that doesn't happen. And buzzword, you know more than me, the buzzword is workload management. We can manage workloads much better knowing that we're doing stuff that directly transfers.
Speaking of the game, I want to go back to this. I know you said your team was able to adapt on the fly a little bit more. Was there any sort of statistical category that your team, and I know you guys had a ton of success during your 14 years at Windsor, but was there any statistical category that your team year in, year out really excelled in?
Unstructured moments is really it. The rough number at our level was somewhere in that 20 to 25%. Of a game was unstructured, what we consider unstructured moments, right? You're not walking the ball up, you're not perfectly organized, or it's off of a turnover, or it's off of some disruption or something like that. And we just found our conversion success was much better in those moments. Now, conversion's a tricky word. We didn't always score, but we found that we were able to get better shots within those moments. And I don't have, I'll be honest, I don't have the stats right in front of me in terms of that, but that was something we charted throughout seasons, and we just tried to determine how good we were in those unstructured moments. And you think about trying to steal points per possession per games, and you think about, okay, are we converting? Well, I'll give you an example. 3-on-2, 2-on-1s, 11-man breaks, different drills like that. Here's one problem with them. They're a good starting point, but if you're still doing that drill in the middle of the year and at the end of the year, then you're not simulating the game. Because the game, there's never been a 3-on-2, a 2-on-1 that happened the way that those drills shape the opportunity. Those opportunities are never that structured, and they're never that scripted. So we would try and create more chaotic situations within practice to work on advantage, disadvantage, and that would be more of a direct simulation of these unstructured moments, which, again, we tried to take pride in. We would always bring this back to our players and say, listen, you know, any unstructured situations we're prepared for, right? If a team comes out and starts running something we've never seen, or, you know, they came up with a new offense just for our game, we'll be fine. We played so much in practice versus these unstructured situations that you can adapt and you can figure it out. And it's really a great confidence to your players, to be honest, which is another mindset of all this, is that it gives your players confidence that they can adapt and they can overcome.
Yeah, and I think it'd be a fun way to play is to, you know, actually get to play in practice. You know, I've been through so many practices where it's just drill after drill after drill, and that gets boring. You know, after a while, that can get monotonous and mindless. It seems more fun. And going back to what you said, like, I don't know that I've ever heard it described in that way, unstructured moments being a part of the game that you can win. You know, you hear people talk about winning the transition battle, and I think probably transition is a little bit different than what you're talking about, because when you think transition, you think, you know, an advantage situation, where it sounds like what you're talking about is maybe just, you know, not necessarily a fast break, but somewhere between that secondary and primary and set offense. Yeah.
Let's bring that out a little bit more, because, like, let's think about it this way. Is unstructured moments, which I don't think get enough attention from coaches, and I might actually think this is my mindset moving forward, should I coach again, is I think I would start with the end in mind. So think about starting with the end of your sets, not the beginning of your sets. Really, you and I can come up with thousands of really good starting points for sets, but what happens at the end of those sets? What happens in reaction? By that, I mean penetration reaction, offensive rebounding reaction, second cut reaction, which is when the ball is dead or someone cuts off the ball in terms of a dribble drive situation. And what happens in those situations? Because those, to me, are the unstructured moments as well that I lump into that category and say, okay, fine, ran the set, great. We didn't create advantage, or we created advantage, but we didn't directly score yet. But now we've got them in the blender, or now we've got them, oh, we got an offensive rebound. What are we doing with that unstructured moment? Are we bringing it out and resetting? Well, again, we tried not to. We tried to play in those unstructured moments and try and take advantage of advantage. Or, as in the example of a second cut, someone dribbles, they're dead, or someone dribbles into trouble and they use some type of bounce out dribble or Nash zone dribble to get out of trouble. We're okay. This is not a problem. This isn't something that we can handle, because we work on those moments. And that's what I really mean by those unstructured moments, in addition to what you said.
It sounds similar, and I'm not super versed in this coach, but it sounds similar to what Nate Oates teaches with his advantage basketball, and just trying to create one long closeout and then playing through that. Have you talked to him? I know you guys were probably pretty close in distance when he was in Detroit. And I listened to your podcast with him. Did you guys collaborate a lot?
Yeah. So what's interesting with Nate is that we never, never spent any time together when he was in Michigan, which is crazy. But, you know, like, I knew about him a little bit, and I don't think he really knew the stuff I was doing at that time. But then after he left for Buffalo, yeah, we've become very good friends, and I visited them, and, you know, and had just great experiences. But he's a tremendous coach, and I think everyone should study what he does, because I do believe that a lot of what they do, you know, suits this philosophy, and just again trying to take advantage of advantage and then clearly counter disadvantage. And that's the other part of it. And great play sequencing and different things like that. And there's a lot of coaches that do that. And I've been aligned with a lot of them, but coaches can study. I mean, Josh Schertz at Lincoln Memorial Division II and Doug Novak at Bethel Division III. There's coaches at all levels that do some really good stuff in this way. And I think those guys do a great job.
At what point in your career did you kind of seek out something more than just the traditional way that it's been done or been taught and look into, you know, some research-based methods for learning and discover BDT?
Well, for me, it started when I did my master's. I did my master's at the University of Victoria when I was 26. And I had been an assistant. I had a chance to coach really young and had some experiences. And I would say I was always aligned with the fact that, one, practice wasn't as enjoyable as it should be for players. And that had a lot to do with just they didn't get to play basketball a lot in practice. It was a lot of games and almost as stereotypical. They had to wait till the end of practice until they got to play, right? Oh, we're going to do all these drills, and then at the end of practice, we're going to let you play. And then when we let you play, we're not going to coach you. And I've seen this situation so much at so many levels where it's like a coach will go crazy during a drill, coach him there, coaching the crap out of a drill. Hey, you got to have your pinky out on the closeout. And if you don't, you run. Or if you don't, we run, blah, 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 blah. And then when they start to play the game, not one time did the coach stop it when the player didn't have their pinky out on the closeout. And it's great that you have that level of detail, but practice is not a coaching clinic, right? Practice is for players, and practice is for players improving so that they can be better in the game. So that all aligned with me kind of at a really young age, because when I did my master's, I spent a lot of time with skill acquisition ideas, motor learning ideas. And I was just grateful for this learning. And I kept looking at it, and it took me a long time, to be honest, in a sense, to make it practical, because that's the one challenge with all this evidence-based research is it's great. It sounds great in principle, but how do you make it practical? And it took me a long time and a lot of different connections and a lot of different sports and a lot of different learning. But it aligned with me very young that I was like, we're going to try and play the game as much as possible. Because it just makes sense to me that more of that would transfer. If we're talking about this concept of transfer, more of that would just naturally transfer. Even if I screw up and I'm the worst coach in history, what I'm saying, at least we're playing the games and my players are getting game reps. You know, the other part of this, Adam, that I found, I was getting game reps. And here's where I think a lot of coaches really miss the boat, especially assistants who don't get a chance to coach that much, obviously within games, but even head coaches that don't have a lot of games. I had this many more game reps coaching because we were coaching the game in practice. Like all these 5-on-5 situations that we did in practice, I got to learn how to identify things on offense, on defense. I coached both sides of the ball at the same time. And I got to learn how to perceive, decide, and then execute a decision, just like the process the player would go through, ironically, and then get feedback on that. And I got all these game reps coaching because of how we practice. And it just made sense for me because it's really hard to become a game coach with only 25 games, 30 games a year. But then, well, what if you're doing 60 practices? You're getting that many more game reps. So that aligned with me very young. And then, just I would say over the last, I mean, I've been all in probably on the last 10 years. I'm just saying we're doing to do 5-on-5 every day of practice, almost every moment. But, even before that, I was very much in line with the games approach.
And you clearly have a passion for sharing this stuff. Like, I feel like a lot of coaches, when they have something a little cutting edge or unique, you know, that's kind of a house secret. And they use it to get their success. And you're really not like that. Your motto is to share the game. And obviously that's something you're passionate about. And that's taken you all over the world, speaking to different coaches. Is that something that was always in you, or did you develop, you know, that joy for talking hoops later on? Where did that come from?
Well, I think I reflect back on all my learning moments and go, how many times I asked questions of people as I was developing and I was learning, and how many times they were willing to share with me. And I think that just resonated back with me saying, man, like, I can't believe that I've got all these opportunities in coaching as a young coach in Canada. I developed, I improved because so many people were willing to share with me. And I always go back to that and going, man, that servitude that to the game or that servitude to, you know, whatever their passion was just incredible. And that's always resonated. So I think that's really what came of that is that I think it was influenced by so many people that shared with me to be able to share. But I'll be honest, and you know this, it's intimidating. It is intimidating putting your stuff out there because it's far more open for criticism. It's far more open for questioning. And I have to say, I am welcoming of people that disagree. I'm welcoming of people that agree. I'm welcoming of people that ask questions. And that part has made me such a better coach, especially since Basketball Immersion started about 2014. And man, I come back to that now and I kind of think, why would a coach not share their stuff? Because it just makes it stronger. Like I give it to people like you and you've come back to me and you've asked a question or you've come back to me with something you've done. And now I'm thinking, man, why didn't I do that? Man, he's made it better. And that's been brilliant. That's been such a tremendous part. And I'm so grateful for so many people that have connected with me through Basketball Immersion at The Ball Immersion on Twitter, but also the Basketball Podcast now, which as you know, running the podcast, I mean, just what a methodology to be able to connect with people and to get feedback back on so many different things that you share through coaches. And it's been tremendous.
What's your favorite podcast that you've done to date? I'm sure there's plenty, but what's the one that was the most enjoyable for you personally?
Well, again, this one, right?
Present. Oh,
focus.
Come
there
on.
You go. This one.
the one that got deleted.
yeah, probably. But, you know, probably again, like Messina, someone like that who, and there's all of them. I mean, from everyone we've already mentioned, you know, to the ones that I look back at, so many of them and I think, man, I'm so grateful for these coaches coming on and just being open and sharing. But, you know, I'm trying to think, like, probably an easier question would be, or a harder question would be ask me what one I didn't enjoy. Because that's really been the remarkable part, that I've left very few of the conversations going, that wasn't my best, or that wasn't their best, or something like that. And that's what's really resonated with me. But I look at a guy like Messina and just go, this dude is the epitome of world-class coach, humble, doesn't ever act like he's a world-class coach, and is just an incredible sharer. Like, I'm telling you, I mean, again, that's a role model for me. That's a dude that I'm going, man, like when you see him in clinic, he doesn't get up there and tell you stories. He doesn't get up there and tell you about his dog. He gets up there and just goes right into how we defend floppy based on whether the ball's on the dead top or off the top or slightly weak side and different things like that. It just gets right into kind of like stimulating thinking. And that's what I love. And that's what I've loved about so many coaches that I've shared. But that would be picking one of those examples of many.
Well, that's really a testament to you because I think you do a great job of getting people right to that high level X's and O's conversations that really stimulate, you know, the back and forth conversations that you guys have. I think you're great at that. You get rid of all the fluff and get right into it, which is awesome.
Well, thank you. And like, you know, this, like, and I think more people have to think this, like what's more valuable than an answer is the question. Right? The question is what brings out so much. And whether the question I ask or the question someone asks of me brings you the answer you want, at least it sends you down that rabbit hole of thinking about something. And I've just been so, so blessed to have so many people that have influenced that in me too, with just the ability to ask a good question or to ask a question, period. Like, Adam, how many people have you met in life? You know, maybe you never knew them before. Maybe they're your wise friends or something like that. And you have a conversation and they never ask you a question. I'm just not aligned with those people. Like, I love people that ask questions because those are the people that I find that I learn the most from based on the questions they bring out.
And so if people have questions for you, Chris, how can they find you? Basketballimmersion.com?
You know, so many places, and that's the beautiful thing. So at B-Ball Immersion on Twitter is probably the easiest, or Basketball Immersion on Instagram. I find that those are the two places people are interacting the most. My email, coliver@basketballimmersion.com. They're welcome to contact me there. And I just, you know, I just hope so many people keep connecting and following and supporting and, you know, clearly interacting with the material, whether you like it or don't like it, just interact with the material, because that makes us all better as coaches. And, you know, I mean, I never would have thought, like, and, you know, you're doing this full time, I'm doing this full time, we're sharing the game full time, you know, in servitude to the game. And, you know, I get to travel to all these amazing, I'm going to Sweden, I'm going to New Zealand, Australia, throughout North America this year, to be able to interact with coaches. So I just hope they continue to interact with the material. And that's such a blessing.
Well, and I'll tell you this, and I want to ask you a little bit more about the website in a minute, but one thing that I'm really passionate about, and that what we're trying to continue to create with Rising Coaches, is community. And you've done a great job of creating a community within Basketball Immersion. Everywhere I go, whatever event, whether it's the Final Four or the NBA Summer League, there's always, you have a very, very loyal tribe of Basketball Immersion followers that always talk about it and are very in tune to what you're doing. And that's something I want to compliment you on, because, again, that is our mission, is to create community within basketball. And I think you've done an outstanding job of that.
Well, thank you. That's outstanding to hear. And I've seen it more this summer, and you're probably seeing it too, that when you travel, you're just more likely to connect with people that have spent time with your materials. And it just, again, such a rewarding, incredible experience. So thank you for saying that.
So if you go on basketballimmersion.com, those materials are available. I think you can, maybe you can tell me more, but it looks like you can purchase some videos individually, or you can sign up for a membership, which is, I think, only it's $247 a year?
Yeah, $247 a year. So really, it's the membership. I mean, there aren't as many individual videos, but I give away. I mean, this is the mindset for people if they're ever interested in this type of business type of model. Is one thing I learned really early is give away your best stuff. You're doing in practice, you know, and I gave away BDT shooting and this basketball decision training concept, and that's something that helped grow it. And then, you know, obviously give away plays, all this other stuff. But Basketball Immersion itself, there's 500 plus videos of exactly what we do. Like it's what I do at practice. It's me in clinics. It's me in camps. It's exactly what we do. And then the other part is that we started these master classes, which has helped grow our community as much as anything, which is every Tuesday night we do a master class, which means we pick a subject. We did a deep dive the other night on me discussing five or six things that I experimented with through summer camps this summer. And I love summer camps because I get a chance to try some stuff with kids in a non-pressure environment. And I came up with kind of five or six things that I was like, wow, this is stuff I wasn't doing last year. Now I would not do it. And it was just really fun. So I got to be able to share that with coaches on a Zoom call. And then that's available for them who want to delay if they can't make it as well.